My name is Jody Kretzman, and this is a session called Renewing Communities. It has a subtitle, Stories and Lessons from a U.S. Odyssey. And we're going to make this, I hope, pretty informal.
Almost cozy.
An intimate four-by group.
Prime time.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's fun to be among friends and do this. And it's really fun to sort of think about this stuff that we've been up to for the last 5 or 6 years at Holden, because a lot of this stuff is about community. Sort of thinking about community in the late 20th century, early 21st century, in an advanced industrial society, and what that's about, and how it is we might be thinking about renewing the space that communities allow us to have. Let me just give you a little bit of background about where this comes from, especially for you, Richard, because I know both Joe and Elmer kind of know at least a lot of the bits and pieces and major themes of this work. But most of my life in the last almost 30 years now has been in cities, and mostly with the center in Chicago. And I left early on my heart, I think, on a street corner someplace on the west side of Chicago. I've been centered there ever since. And my view of the world is either from a church basement on the west side or a bar stool on the west side or someplace else where community gathers and thinks about stuff and tries to think about how to rebuild cities. That work has had a lot of twists and turns over the years, but it's all basically been about communities and about cities. About 5 years ago, one of the places where I hang my hats, which is the Center for Urban Affairs and Policy Research at Northwestern University, through that place, we got a fairly sizable chunk of money to involve myself and a couple of colleagues in a new set of projects that was really not new at all. The corner of the Center for Urban Affairs at Northwestern, which is the largest urban research center in the United States attached to a private university, the corner of the center that we've always sort of had as part of where we've done work is a corner that has not asked the big macro policy questions, but it's asked instead the question, how is it that communities solve problems? How can local communities solve problems? Not city governments, not state, not federal, but how can local communities solve problems? What we got about 5 years ago was a good chunk of money from the Chicago Community Trust, the Community Foundation in Chicago. It was surprising for us, a surprising source for this work. A chunk of money which allowed us to set off on what I've called today an odyssey. And what it allowed us to do was to spend time in the, the 20 to 30 largest cities in the United States. And within those cities, in the most devastated neighborhoods in those cities. But when we got to the devastated neighborhoods, we didn't do what most academics do when they get to devastated neighborhoods and cities, which is to really focus on the incredible disasters that those communities have become, the incredible depth and challenge of the problems faced by those communities. Instead, what we set out to do was to collect success stories. Collect stories about stuff that was working, from the South Bronx to the east side of Detroit to Roxbury in Boston, to the west side and south side, Pilsen, Chicago, to St. Louis, Kansas City, South Central Los Angeles. And we, I cannot describe what a delight it has been to get to know folks who are doing incredible things in those communities. And a lot of the stories that we came up with are really sort of headline makers. They're highly visible, they're big scale. They're the Bethel stories, right? Where you get a little church 15 years ago in Bethel on the west side of Chicago, Richard, right? 15 years ago, a little place with about 40 members. Sort of deciding, do we stay or do we go, right? And they decide to stay. And once they decide to stay, they say, what have we got to build on here? And what can we do that's effective in the this place. And the only thing they've got is a mortgage-free church, right? A church building with not a mortgage on it. So what do? They mortgage it right away, right? And with it, they buy a building that's totally shattered down the block. And these 40 or 50 people, after Sunday services every day, go down and redo that building. And within 6 months, they get it up and rolling. They rent it out. They begin to get some income from it, and they buy another building. And now it's 15 years later, and we're talking about a $10 million a year operation on the west side of Chicago that employs 650 people. It runs 22 businesses, right? Which is an incredible source of creative energy. It's now the second biggest employer on the west side of Chicago. It's an amazing story. There's a story that's even bigger than that, which you probably know about, in Newark, New Jersey, right? Where a crazy Catholic priest started meeting in his basement with a bunch of folks. This was about 15 years ago. And saying, you know, nothing could be worse than the way it is in Newark at this point. They just had, you know, a generation of disinvestment, absolute devastation. And so
family time.
Family discussion.
Okay, I'm gonna lie down if it's like.
Yeah, please do.
Already, I wish that my wife's taken a course over there from this wonderful liturgical man, and she would be so hard by this. So I gotta really.
Go listen.
Stick with it.
Go buy the tape.
Find the tape. That's right. I got it on the tape.
Yeah.
Joey is very interesting. I think she should be here.
Go to sleep, finger.
A little bias over here.
That's right. So when we get in Newark, then, is the development of what's called the New Communities Corporation, run out of this Catholic church, which is now a $100 million a year operation, runs three huge shopping centers that have sort of rebuilt downtown Newark, is a network which is far more powerful than the local government in Newark. Clearly an effort that is about sort of redefining how it is that communities get rebuilt. You know, in your own neck of the woods, Dick, one of the places that I've been most interested in is an outfit in Roxbury called the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative. I don't know if you know about Dudley Street, but Dudley Street did a wonderful thing. They started, this is about 9 years ago, and it is a community which is it's the lowest income community in Boston, and it is a community which is 60% African American and 30% Cape Verdean, right? Mm-hmm. Their own language,
right.
And 10% Latino. Mm. And they started convening people at the block level about 9 years ago in a bottom-up kind of community planning process. And it is this year, it's been 9 years now, that they're starting to build their first homes. In fact, they've got now a couple hundred built there. But their planning process was so powerful and has involved so many people. And the community has, in fact, accomplished so much in terms of local problem solving that the city of Boston was persuaded, it's the only story like this in the U.S. that I know of, was persuaded to give over to this scruffy little neighborhood group their power of eminent domain, right? Mm-hmm. So that the neighborhood, which now has 35% vacant land, controls that land. They own it and they control it, and they can therefore shape the future of the neighborhood. And as you know, Dudley Street is close enough into downtown Boston that it's in danger, even though it's incredibly devastated, of being gentrified.
Right.
But they now own and control the land, so they can figure out ways of taking advantage of the market pressures, but at the same time making it work for people who are there. So there's a bunch of those really sort of high visibility stories that are multi-million dollar stories, had a lot of zeros at the end of them, and are very exciting, and I think, in fact, hold some interesting promise of redefining urban polity. That is, cities probably are too big to govern at this point. And what you've got here is a whole series of communities which, in fact, are taking on governance roles in a variety of ways. But it wasn't just the big stuff that we were after, because we knew about these three stories ahead of time. It was fun to get to know the people better that were involved in them, begin to work with them on some stuff. But what was really incredible was to get to know the smaller stories across, the sort of block-level stories where you've got people sort of redefining the issue of safety, you know, and taking on block by block how it is you say, this is our community, we know what it takes to reclaim our kids, we understand what that means economically and spiritually, it's often spiritual, and we're gonna do that, and we're not gonna look to cops to do it, because they can't do it for us, right? Or we're not any longer gonna look to, people call it, teachers in schools to bring up our kids, we'll do it ourselves. In a whole variety of ways of people taking back what's theirs, in fact. One of the most heartening sets of developments has been in public housing, where we spend a lot of time working with public housing residents across the country. And the whole movement toward resident management councils in public housing, and in some places, ownership of public housing, is incredible. These are women who have gotten the outrageous idea into their head that public housing could be theirs, right? And in fact, they could manage it. And now you can find in St. Louis, in Washington, D.C., even in Chicago, you can find public housing buildings that are absolutely gleaming and safe, and where people have jobs, and where people choose to stay, and where families stay together. Public housing. I mean, it's just not part of the story that we hear. And it's all about resident management. There's one building that has resident management in Cabrini Green.
Is that right?
Okay? And it just stands out because there's no crime there. Those women run it, and everybody knows who runs it. Right? And it looks different. I mean, it looks like people have pride in it. There's just, it's clearly standing out. So, there are hundreds of stories that are little, that are not headline grabbers, that are not multi-million dollar stories out there, which we were we were more interested in those than we were in the really big ones. So what we did was we just went around to cities and we used sort of networks of friends and informants in cities across the country that put us in touch with people, and we just spent time hearing their stories. Mm-hmm. And then we spent a lot of time thinking with people about what the stories meant and how it is you could begin to put them next to each other and think about lessons that might be applicable more widely across the country as we think about rebuilding cities in the 21st century. So that's the background. And what I wanted to do, and this seems a little bit, I think I probably won't do that. If it were a bigger group, I think I would have tried to tie in some ancient stories here too. I mean, I think I won't do this entirely here, but you all are, I have come to reread, for instance, stories like the feeding of the 5,000 differently now, right? Where it's clear to me that one reading, this was partly in a conversation with Parker Palmer, this became clear to me, that one reading, the feeding of the 5,000, is very much about Jesus the organizer, who, when the disciples say, the people are hungry, what we'll do about that, Jesus, is we'll disperse them and send them into the villages to buy food so they're not so hungry, which is a pretty logical thing to say. But Jesus doesn't buy it. Mm-hmm. He hears something different from that suggestion. And I think there is something to the way he hears it, because what he says instead is, no, why don't you put them together in small groups? Put them in face-to-face groups so that they can see each other, and so they learn their names, each other's names, and they're sort of starting to talk to each other, like the last couple of days here, right? And then let's see what happens with this food problem. And clearly, one reading of this is that you have a set of solutions suggested by the disciples, which are about large, in-place markets. And the disciples, in fact, may be suggesting a kind of Reaganomics solution, that you go out into the marketplace, right, and you buy what you can buy, and whatever you can afford is what you can afford. Mm-hmm. But Jesus says, no, probably for a number of reasons. Probably some of these people can't afford to go out and buy it. And what we ought to do is to form communities. Communities understood as places where people are individuals, where they're known, where they're unique, where they have names, where folks can reach out and touch them. And he puts them together in those groups. And the result is, of course, abundance. It is absolute abundance. Now, what is that? Were people hiding the stuff in their back pockets? Maybe. Maybe they were, right? Maybe it is that there was more there than they would admit when and the disciples went around and said, what have you got? Right? Oh, geez, it's only 5 and 2. But then it turns out that there's whole baskets full out there as soon as the small groups call them out, as soon as the small communities. So the tagline on that story might say something like, the road from scarcity, which is in fact the definition of economics, right? I mean, economics, one reason for it being called the dismal science, right, is that it assumes scarcity, right? So the road from economics or scarcity to abundance always lies through community. And through community understood as a very sort of personal calling forth of all the gifts of the people, which turned out to be more loaves and fishes than anybody knew was there. And I think if there's a lesson that we have found in this Odyssey, that is the primary lesson, it is that lesson about the connection between community and abundance in a context where scarcity is the mainstream assumption. See? Mm-hmm. I think that's what we're... Let me just say a few other things, and then I'd just like to sort of talk with you all informally about it. The way we've started to think about these lessons, we're trying to collect them and then sort of feed them back in ways that make sense to folks, because we've learned it all from community people, right? And I guess one way to sort of report in very, very brief outline form what it is we've learned. Had a long conversation with a wonderful woman who's the director of a group called Banana Kelly, the Banana Kelly Development Corporation in the South Bronx. And she was a woman who was 70 years old, who'd been in the South Bronx her whole life. And she was telling us the story of the South Bronx. And I said at one point, Margaret, when you look around here at the South Bronx now, and you see all this devastation, do you have an explanation for it? What do you think? What do you think happened here? Because you lived through it. And she said, we talked about that then a long time, but I think I can boil it down into three things that she told us. She said, first of all, this community used to be a community that was absolutely plugged into an economic future, and now we're unplugged, she said. We've been unplugged from the mainstream economy. And she said there are communities like that all over New York. And I think that's a good way of thinking about it. In more and more communities, Elmer, when you were in Chicago, working class communities were based on the kinds of jobs that we lost. We've lost 400,000 in Chicago, 400,000 industrial jobs, right, over the last 20 years. And every major city has seen that happen. The jobs obviously moving out or just disappearing. And those were the kinds of jobs that people didn't need an education for, didn't need to go to high school. All they needed was a willingness to work. And then they could begin to get a stake in the community, and they could begin to imagine something better for their kids and all that. Well, this is all something that was not new to us, and it's not new to you, but she was bright about it. She understood that there was a relationship between the booming of downtown Manhattan and the devastation of the Bronx, too, that you can begin to get cities now that look more like what we thought the third world would look like, right, where you've got booming, you know, where there may be only rich and poor, and the room for the working middle classes is just not there in the economy any longer. That's what so this image of an unplugged community, disconnected from the mainstream economy, stayed with us. She said that the second thing that I think that she was telling us about that day was that not only did the private jobs leave, but so did a whole lot of other institutions that used to be at the center of community life, so that the not-for-profit and public sector institutions also have either fled or become incredibly less effective, right, than they used to be. Again, in Chicago at this point, we have lost a dozen hospitals in the last 10 years, just shut down, couldn't make it economically, right? And when you think about all of the churches that have left and all of the, you know, the kind of stuff that used to be there, it's not there. But we knew about that, you all know about that, but it's good to remember that because it does sort of put the context differently. But it was the third thing, finally, that she told us, I think, that we've been working on most. And it was a sort of a light bulb experience, although it was not It was not something that we had thought about in some ways before that. She said, the third thing that Margaret said to us was that, you know, the worst thing that's happened to us here in the South Bronx is that we now live in a prison. And she said that the prison that we are in isn't one that is made up of visible bricks and mortar, and it doesn't have barbed wire around it. But it is basically a prison made up of people's ideas and images about who we are, right? And she talked about that in terms of a prison. People's ideas and images of who we are. She said, I can't go any place in the South, in New York City, or in the suburbs of New York City, and say the words South Bronx without people immediately having flashing in front of their heads, in front of their brains, a whole series of images, you see, that are about violence and crime and teen pregnancy and welfare and joblessness and homelessness and abandoned buildings, and just they are unrelenting, and they are absolutely consistent, and they're all about needs and problems and deficiencies and emptiness, right? What she was telling us was that as long as people's ideas about the South Bronx were that clearly monolithic and powerful, that there was no hope for rebuilding the South Bronx. And that was the idea then that we've been sort of playing with, both with her and with other people across the U.S. And we played with it. One of the ways we played with it, just to show you a couple of quick things here that we did. One of the ways we played with it was to say, it is as if what she's describing to us is as if people had a kind of mental map appearing in front of their faces. When we say South Bronx, this happens. Can you see that? This is a neighborhood needs map, right? Focuses. That's clear enough, isn't it? Okay. Don't pay any attention to the spacing or to the amount of space, but it's a way of thinking about a paradigm, if you will, if you want to use that kind of language. This is what you think of, isn't it? When you hear South Bronx, when you hear public housing, when you hear Roxbury, when you hear West Side in Chicago, when you hear South Central Los Angeles. And it is unremitting. And I want to just think about this for a minute, because we've been thinking about this with people for the last little while. Let me just say a word or two about this map and its unremittingness and what the problem is with it, if I could. Just let me say a word about its nature, its origins, and its consequences. If it's true that this is a map that defines what we think about the South Bronx, the first thing I want to say about it is that the problem with this map is not that it is a false map. This is a true map. All this stuff is true in the South Bronx. You've got it, right? You got it all over public housing, you got it over the south side of Chicago. The problem with this map is that it's not the whole truth, and that it is treated as if it's the whole truth, right? So, I mean, one of the things we do know, we're thinking with either neighborhood folks or policy people about this stuff, is to go back to the simple-minded old glass stuff, right, with a glass that is half full and half empty, right? And remind us all, right, that this is a glass that's like us, right? That we are all people that are filled and empty. We understand this, I think, some as Lutherans.
Yes.
We ought to, anyway. And I often tell stories about friends of mine who are colleagues at Northwestern, you know, at the Center for Urban Affairs, who are bright, wonderful people, but who are incredibly empty people. My colleagues at Northwestern can't keep marriages together, and their kids don't talk to them, and they drink too much, and they take drugs, and they can't work sometimes, and they are a mess. They are empty, needy, problematic, deficient people who, if they wanted to focus on their emptiness, could keep an army of social workers and counselors, right, and helpers and professionals together for years, well paid. But I think the simple-minded thing we always keep coming back to is that it's true at Northwestern Center for Urban Affairs, as it is in every congregation and every neighborhood that you've ever lived in that works right, is that those neighborhoods and working organizations and working congregations are always built on the fullness of people who are also empty, on the gifts and skills and capacities, resources of people who are also needy and problematic and deficient. And that therefore the question about this glass never is it half full or is it half empty, right? The question is, which half do you focus on? Mm-hmm. Do you focus on the fullness to begin with, or do you focus on the emptiness to begin with? And so the problem with this is that it is a way of focusing entirely on the emptiness of individuals in the community in which they live. And what we have done, therefore, is to construct over the last 25 years, with the best of intentions, an entire superstructure of institutions based on the idea that people and whole people and communities are entirely empty. Right? And that's what our friend Margaret in the South Bronx was calling the prison. Right? And I begin to think about it now as it's probably the major block to thinking creatively about how one rebuilds cities and communities. Let me just say a couple more things about this map. When I think about one of the things that's become clear to me is that the people in communities where we work didn't draw this map about themselves. Right? Somebody else did.
Yeah.
So we have been moved to ask who? Who are the suspects? And I, let me tick off a couple. I would put my own institution, the university, at the top of the list. I think a lot of social science, at least the kind that I, what produces some valuable stuff, but a lot of social science, I think, is basically about quantifying misery. It is about deepening and sort of reifying this map. You know, it's about looking at problems and feeding them in ever more statistically sophisticated ways into computers, and therefore making them late 20th century gods in this sense. Right? Mm-hmm. So that I think the university created this map. And I think though that there were handmaidens in this journey of map creation. I would put most of philanthropy in the United Way into this map creation mode. I think every time the United Way or the foundation world or maybe even the church sometimes starts out a funding cycle by asking a local community to do a needs survey. That is a way, that's a tool that's been invented to ask local communities to draw this map about itself, about themselves. A needs survey says, tell us how desperate your situation is and we'll give you money, right? And I think it's a diabolical tool at this point. But we're all into it, right? We all do it. I think also probably government human services, although, you know, wield huge clout based on this map. And I think finally the mass media are probably married to this map. I mean, you know, in Chicago, I mean, I think mass media basically are wedded to the most spectacular instances of this map, the 19 kids on the west side.
Right.
We'll never know
the whole story.
No, we will, though. I mean, we do.
Yeah.
I mean, folks do in the community. It's a complicated and very interesting story in lots of ways. Lots of problems there, but it was not the story we got. What we got was this map blown up, right? And it was a story that went around the globe, right? And that's what people think when they think about Keystone and West Garfield now. And one of my questions is always with this map, how heavily is the church implicated? How much do we need to be needed in this way? How addicted are we to seeing people as recipients of service, as empty people whom we can fill in some way? There's a sense in which I now think about inner city congregations as either married to this map or drawing the one. And there are lots that are doing both, I think, at this point. That's a word about the origins of this map. I think, just a couple words about the consequences. The worst consequence, I think, is that although this map is not drawn by people in communities like the South Bronx and the west side of Chicago, lots of people begin to believe it's true. Begin about themselves. You know, you get told often enough that this is who you are, this is what your environment is, and this is what it's about. I begin to believe that that's true about myself. Once that starts to happen, it's very, very difficult to bring people back. It's why it's so tough to work in public housing, because the public housing environment is one that has been defined in this way almost entirely. It's why it's such a miracle when you see these things happening within public housing.
A generation upon generation.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. But there's some other consequences. So you think about, if this is the map that defines reality, think about what local community leadership is like, right? If my job as a community leader depends partly on my capacity to get resources into my neighborhood, what I am asked to do every morning, right, to get resources into my neighborhood is to draw this map or ensure that my funding sources know that the teen pregnancy rate in my neighborhood is worse than any place else in Chicago, therefore I should get the money. That the gang problem is worse in my neighborhood than any place else, I should get the money. And that's my job. And then, after I've done that, I'm supposed to lead the people whom I just denigrated, who I've just decided have nothing, right? Who I've just decided have no hope at all. Right? And it's just, it's no wonder community leadership gets burned out, feels pulled in opposite directions, right? So that's clearly a devastating problem. It's also clear that this map directs money, right? The money gets put into these categories.
That's right.
Another way we decided on how this map ought to look is to say, are these 15 categories, which if you put them at the top of a grant application, will get money, and they are.
And you make other situations fit.
Yes,
into
exactly.
Those categories, even if those aren't the right
ones. Whatever's getting funded this year.
Of course.
You can do it. You can do whatever getting funded this year. Yeah. But you
know, that game, I know.
Absolutely. What that does, though, is it busts up the community wisdom. And community wisdom knows, number one, that all these problems, insofar as they're there, are interrelated. They're all intertwined. They're part of a web. And they may be, in fact, simply symptoms of a larger problem, which is something like the breakdown of the community's capacity to do problem solving itself. It could be that, could be in fact that that's the fundamental problem, and that these are all sort of symptomatic of that. This obviously also is a map, because it's the only map to reality that depends not only on, that determines not only where the money is spent, but who gets it. Right? I mean, we did a little study about 8 years ago on the west side of Chicago, in which we tried to figure out how much money was coming in targeted to poor people, in some way targeted to poverty. And we were very conservative. We didn't count any criminal justice money or education money. And we got something like $25,000 per family of four. Right? Coming into the west side, targeted in some way to poor people. But you know what the kicker is, right? Of that 25,000, 18,000 went elsewhere. 7,000 went to poor people. Mm-hmm. 7,000 went to poor people. 18,000 went to helpers, went to professionals, went to, in fact, 50% of that, a little over 50%, went to the medical system. It went, in other words, to build the walls of the prison institutions that Margaret was telling us about in the South Bronx. Right? So some of our more cynical friends on the west side now say that study proved that it takes only one good poor neighborhood to support two middle class ones.
Efficient town.
Absolutely, it's a very efficient system. I think the last thing I want to say about this map, and then I want to just talk for a second about what I think is going on. But this map for me now is a way of a sort of shorthand, simple way of understanding hopelessness. And I don't think if this is, and I mean hopelessness now from the way it is experienced by a kid on a street corner in Roxbury or on the west side, all the way to the White House. For a kid on a street corner, if this is my community, if I understand that this is what's around me, I have no reason not to take the quick money. not to do whatever is in front of me that brings me money today, because there's nothing to invest in here. There's no future here. There's nothing that's about me 10 years down the pike in this community here, if this is the map that I know about, right? And it's also a way to explain, I think, the hopelessness that you see in Capitol Hill or the White House. Because if this is the only map one thinks about here, South Bronx, this is an endless hole down which resources could be poured forever. And you know about this hole that it's just going to be deeper next year. And there's no hope here for change. Because this is at most a map about individual survival, right? In the absence of community building or a working economy. So I've become convinced that this is a map that has led us to disaster. The good news is that one of the central things that all of the hundreds of success stories have in common is that they all are about people coming together in a whole variety of situations, beginning to think about solving problems locally, and seeing that the first thing that they need to do that, is to throw this map out. And to say, you know, whatever this map is in terms of its truth about us, it's not the whole truth. So what we've been playing with then is how it is people have been drawing a new map about who they are. And this is one sort of quick representation of the kind of thing I think they're beginning to work on all across the country. This is a simple-minded reminder that every community is made up of at least the gifts of individual citizens that need to get rediscovered and mobilized. And this map sort of points to a lot of our interest, which is in rethinking how it is not only you find the gifts of people who are central leaders in a community, right? Alinsky used to tell us that, right? Go in and find the natural leaders. But how it is you also then rediscover the giftedness of people who are on the margins of community. You know, folks who are somehow thought to be mostly deficient because they're too young and they therefore need to get put in schools, because they're too old, therefore they don't have anything to give, because they're labeled developmentally disabled or something, and therefore they are. So a lot of what we've been doing is watching where communities have figured out ways to take people at the margins of communities and reconnect them to the centers of communities, not institutionalize them and treat them on the basis of diagnosis of emptiness, but rediscover fullness and connect them with the community. That's very exciting stuff. The connecting mechanism in communities is a space that we have almost forgotten about. And it's a powerful space, though, that is still there that the church is key to. And that's the citizens' associational space. And the sort of simple kind of definitional distinction that we've been working with here, that associations are groups of people who come together to do an activity or solve a problem and mostly don't get paid. And institutions are places where people get paid to do the work, okay? I mean, that's a simple-minded way of thinking about it.